Once a month, we visit with a researcher from the University of Oregon about some of the discoveries being made or at least sought at the UFO. We call the monthly visit Curious, Research Meets Radio. This month, we focus on bees. They are a cause of great concern at the moment because so much depends upon them and because their populations have been crashing in recent years. Lauren Panicio is an assistant professor of biology, the head of the Panicio Lab, and a member of the Institute of Ecology and Evolution at the UFO. She was one of the authors of recent research on wild bees in California's Central Valley and has been spending some time looking into bee populations returning after wildfires. Dr. Panicio, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Good morning. So your recent arrival at the UFO, talk about the decision to move from California with its incredible bee diversity to Oregon.
Well, Oregon does have quite a few bees as well, but I was really attracted by UFO's data science programs. So they're setting up a new data science institute, and so I'll be teaching intro data science there, and so they kind of recruited me over to be part of that.
Data science, is it exactly what it sounds like, where you just pulling a lot of data to be able to figure out trends?
Exactly. So it's, and actually we use bee examples in class. We actually use this data set to analyze it as an example, but it's like everything data, you know, how to analyze it, how to clean it, how to do all those things, so... As ecologists, we're increasingly needing to have many different skills, and same with, you know, social scientists and all those different things. So a lot of people who study bees also study data science.
I think I know what you mean when you say clean it. I know as journalists, we have to figure out what stuff doesn't belong, you know, which one of these is not like the other. Is that essentially what you're talking about there?
Yes, exactly. A lot of times you get a data set and there's a bunch of weird things in there, and you have to be like, was that, you know, did you mean to have missing data there, or was that a zero? You know, was that a misspelling, or is that actually a different place? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So outside of the data, give us a sense of the general thrust of your work with bees, where you focus that research.
Great. I work a lot on trying to understand how we can restore bee populations in agriculture, and also how we can restore them in forests, like after wildfires.
Okay, so on those two fronts, I mean, I noticed the recent research, the stuff we referenced at the beginning here, about wild bee populations. So, I mean, let's distinguish here first. Let's clean up some data here right up front. When we're talking about wild bees, we're not talking about the honeybees. The honeybees are the non-native ones, right?
Yes, exactly. So we have about 4,000 species of bees in the U.S. There's about 1,500 in California. We have a couple hundred in Oregon. And those are different from the honeybees, which are from Europe and are imported from Europe. Actually, the pilgrims were probably the first, were the first ones to bring them to the Americas. And though honeybees are incredibly important, and we use them a lot for agriculture and also honey, of course, they are not native to the Americas.
Would, if the honeybees had not been imported, I mean, is this work that the wild bees had been doing, would be doing?
It is work that the wild bees have been doing. So we didn't really rely on honeybees for pollination up until even in the last 100 years. Because before that time, the wild bees had healthy populations. We didn't do agriculture at the scale we do it now, and the wild bees just did all the work for us.
Oh, interesting. So we had to really, well, like a lot of other things, so it got industrial, and then the bees became part of the industry.
Exactly. And if you think of those, you know, those square honeybee hives that are white and they're kind of like tall, those were really designed for being able to stack on trucks to carry around for pollination. So that was like part of the industrialization of our agricultural system.
Yeah, we've gotten used to seeing those. They look like little chests of drawers sitting out there in the fields.
Exactly, yeah. And they're all, you know, they're really easy to pile onto a big semi-truck.
Mm-hmm. So the when I look at some of your work here, I see a high correlation between bees and other living things around. When there's a greater diversity of bees, it seems like there's more biodiversity generally.
That is often the case. You know, there's this idea of, like, diversity begets diversity. When you have a lot of, you know, diverse flowers, you have a lot of diverse bees, you have other species that rely on those flowers, other insects, as well as like birds. So in general, if we're looking at one group that tends to be pretty sensitive to, you know, really respond to the environment, we can often make, you know, we can often assume that it also affects other species that are similar.
So with all the pressures on bee populations then, I mean, are things moving in the opposite direction? Do we have less biodiversity? Is there less bee diversity?
Well, bees are definitely hit really hard in some areas, and particularly in agriculture, which is not great because that is where we need them the most, of course. Like, that's where we could really use their help with pollination. But if you think of our traditional agricultural system, you know, maybe you guys have driven down the five in California or even in Oregon. It's really large-scale ag a lot of the time, and there isn't a lot of habitat left because we're really trying to maximize production. And because of that, there's just not that much habitat for the bees to actually live. And that's actually one of the reasons why we rely so much on honeybees, because we can, you know, stack them on those trucks and bring them to where we need them, whereas wild bees actually need to live in the place that they, you know, in the agricultural systems.
Okay, so their hives need to be, or whatever structures they have for living in. I don't mean structures, they don't build them. But, well, they do actually when they're honeybees. But okay, I'm really getting myself in a twist here. But the point being that they need to live in a natural environment, not in the chest of drawers out in the, that stacks on a truck.
Exactly. So yeah, some of them, most bees actually live in the soil. They actually excavate these nests deep into the soil, and they make these little chambers, and they lay their eggs in those chambers. And some bees also nest in wood, and you guys have probably seen in stores, they're starting to have these like little bee houses that have these holes in wood, so some bees will use that. And of course, many, many viewers will probably have encountered carpenter bees, maybe in their deck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those will, or the sides of their houses, those will actually make holes in wood. So there's a whole variety of different ways that bees can nest. As you can imagine, I mean, if we have thousands of bee species, they all kind of do it a little differently.
Yeah, they make very perfect little holes in wood, too. I didn't realize it wasn't a drill hole until I heard the buzzing coming from the 4x4.
So, they like to do that.
They do indeed. So talk about the recent publication about pollinator interaction flexibility. What did you and your co-authors set out to find?
So what we wanted to look at is, you know, we're talking about these agricultural landscapes. There's not a lot of natural habitat. And so what people have recommended is, you know, what if we put some natural habitat back in? What if we plant some wild plants and see what comes to them? And we call those hedgerows, kind of like in Great Britain, where it's like this, you know, hedge row. Mm-hmm. And so along the field margins where they don't remove any land from production, and there's a planting, a variety of native plants, a lot of like shrubs and also little tiny forbs and flowers. And we ask, okay, what populations come back here? And through time, we found that they really do support a lot of different wild bee species. Those bee species tend to actually come back year after year. And so it seems like a really good idea in terms of how we can restore bees in agriculture. And the next step we want to know is, okay, but which are the bees that are still struggling? Which are the bees that are most at risk, even in this system with this restoration? And what we found was species that were not very able to switch around their interaction partners, which in this case means flowers, were really at risk. And so they did not persist as well in this landscape. But those that could be really flexible and, you know, visit some flowers one year, some flowers another year, they did a lot better.
Which is kind of the standard evolutionary story, isn't it? If you're able to adapt to the changes in your environment, you stick around?
Exactly. And so when we're thinking about bees, a lot of times, you know, this involves either having a wider diet breadth, so you can think of, you know, like how humans, we eat many different things, like bees could also visit many different flowers, and maybe having the brain capacity to also make these switches, because it actually, you know, think of like a flower, they're kind of complex, and a bee has to be like, okay, how do I get into this, where's the flower, you know, where's the nectar, where's everything like that. And so maybe having that higher capacity might help out. We're not entirely sure. We weren't able to find which traits really related to this ability to switch interaction partners, but we're looking into other options.
Lauren Panizio is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio, our partnership with the University of Oregon, where she is an assistant professor of biology, head of the Panizio Lab, and a member of the Institute of Ecology and Evolution. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have questions or comments about our discussion here about bees. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the flexibility, the ability to adapt, does it appear to be species dependent or maybe more population dependent?
That is a really great question. we were considering it to be a species-dependent trait.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a possibility. I mean, we were looking at one population in the Central Valley, but we haven't gone to another place and looked at those same species and seen whether they vary in their flexibility in those different places.
Exactly the question I was asking. Okay, yeah. I'm curious then to know about it, the hedgerows and how well they work, because it just makes me think about people putting pollinator gardens in their suburban neighborhoods. And granted, a little more open land around the hedgerows, obviously, but whether in fact it is if you build it, they will come kind of situation where if you set these things up that you can attract the bees to them.
You know, that is the fantastic thing about working with bees and bee conservation, because, you know, unlike mammals or amphibians that seem to be a little trickier a lot of the time, like, it does feel like in general with bees, if you build it, they will come, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
We do have questions about things like, you know, whether they have really high parasite loads in places like urban environments where, as you can imagine, like, if this big city and then you have this small patch of flowers in the middle of it, and so that all the bees are kind of congregating on these flowers, and it's kind of like they're not social distancing.
I was waiting for that phrase. Yeah, there it is.
Not social distancing. And they actually transmit parasites through flowers. So flowers are like the doorknobs of the bee world. And so we have actually been asking questions in other research about, you know, when we have this like aggregation of bees in one place, whether this leads to a lot of parasitism. We actually find that in agricultural systems. So some crops bloom, like this giant mass bloom, like sunflower or almonds, like there's just like this huge pulse of flowers and all the bees show up. And we have found that actually does increase rates of parasitism. So we're hoping that, you know, even still, the parasitism isn't so bad, that the populations can still persist. But there are still some open questions. I mean, the answer is, of course, just more flowers,
Right, yeah.
Which sounds great.
Yeah, either that or it's going to be fewer bees, and that's the issue. But yeah, when you talked about how many clustering around individual flowers, it sounds like a lot of, you know, a greater chance for a pathogen to move from one to the other.
Exactly. And so in something like, you know, in Eugene or wherever we are, if more people had gardens that had lots of flowers that produced nectar and pollen, then it wouldn't be such a problem. There wouldn't be that kind of like giant aggregation of bees in one place.
Lauren Panizio, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. She's an assistant professor of biology, head of the Panizio Lab, member of the Institute of Ecology and Evolution at the U of O. I want to ask about bees and fires, though, because you've done some research there not terribly long ago. Tell us what kinds of things you've been looking for and what you've been finding.
Great. And when you guys think of, like, the forests are out there right now, they tend to be pretty close canopy. It's pretty dark. It's often pretty chilly in them. And we don't really see a lot of bees in those closed canopy forests. But once you have a fire, that really opens up the light availability, and all of these gorgeous wildflowers come up, and then the bees show up right afterwards. And so what we looked at was, you know, how does this patchiness of different fires in the forest support bee populations? And this was actually in Yosemite National Park. And we found just the most incredible diversity of bees in these places that had wildfires. And other studies have found the same thing, actually, in Oregon as well. Or in Oregon, Jim Rivers' lab at OSU has looked at high-severity fires in Oregon and found just incredible bee diversity and bee abundance. And so what we'd like to know now is, as these fires are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and these big patches of high severity, so that's where most of the trees have been killed. It's like, you know, when you think of that sort of raised landscape with lots of, you know, dead trees that are all blackened, and mm-hmm. then, you know, there's no living trees left. Those are those high severity patches. And so those keep getting bigger and bigger. And so then we want to ask, you know, is there a size that's too big for bees? That's our question we're hoping to ask this summer.
Do bees ever require a shade per se? I mean, when you're talking about the dark forest, it isn't very welcoming to the bees, but it doesn't have any flowers either for that matter. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
So in a healthy forest, you often see like an understory, like those, you know, like huckleberries and things like that. And sometimes you'll see a bumblebee kind of fly through. But in general, you need that light for the flowers, and then the bees need the flowers. So you need that little bit of light penetration.
So the idea of if you build it, they will come, which sounds like it does actually work relatively often with bees. I mean, is there some level of connectivity that's necessary? I always think about this and learning about things like, you know, corridors for spotted owls and stuff like that. The idea that you can't just make islands of greatness for a particular species. You have to find ways to connect them. So it seems like a lot of people then probably should be planting pollinator gardens if they're really interested in bringing back bee populations.
That would be fantastic. And yes, it is an amazing question. Maybe you should have my job. and we have been thinking more and more about that. And particularly, if you think of these fires, they're like little patches. You know, like there's this thick forest and there's this little patch of fire. And so how close do these patches need to be such that when one patch closes up as the forest, you know, is restored, or not restored, but as the forest grows back in, then, can the bees get to the next patch? And we've also been thinking a lot about clear cuts as part of that system. And, you know, are there seeds we can add to clear cuts? They could be part of that patchwork in the forest. That's a very new project. But we're working with the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation on it, thinking about, what can we plant out there?
Mm-hmm. Did you say the Xerxes Society?
Yes, the Xerxes Society.
Yeah, we talked to them quite a bit, and I know we've talked to them, we usually have conversations about the butterflies and how horrible things are going for them.
Yeah.
No, because let's talk about bee populations. Because we're talking about a 90% plus crash in butterfly populations. Is it like that for wild bees?
It's really variable between species. And one thing that's difficult is we don't have great data of historical samples, or because the populations we've monitored for a really long time are things like deer or fish or things that matter people, like things that we hunt and eat. And we don't hunt and eat bees. And so we don't have the best data on where they were and what abundances they were in. But everything we have is suggesting that populations are getting smaller and some species are going extinct.
Well, yeah, Franklin bumblebee, for example, in southern Oregon hasn't been seen in, 13 years at least.
Yes, and also Bombus occidentalis, which is the western bumblebee, used to be the most common or one of the most common bumblebees in the West and is now completely gone from California, basically. And probably some populations left in the Rockies, or some in the Rockies, but it just disappeared.
Wow. So what's next in your research?
We're looking more into those fire questions, and we're starting to really think a lot about parasites and diseases and viruses and bees and how all of these pieces come together. Because the big question is, how do we support healthy bee populations going forward? We don't want to just bring them to a place like an agricultural environment or an urban environment or, even a fire just to kind of have them all get sick and die. that's the big goal. So learning more about that. And then also, thinking about how do we, the next step, I guess the next agricultural system I'm really interested in is timber. And, how do we add bees to clear cuts? And whenever I look at those mountainsides in Oregon, I'm just like, man, that could be awesome bee habitat.
Oh, just get some flowers in there?
Yeah, let's get some flowers in there.
Wow. All right. Well, we learned a few things about bees today, of course. Lauren Panisio, our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. Lauren's an assistant professor of biology, head of the Panisio Lab, a member of the Institute of Ecology and Evolution, and will be teaching data science as well at the University of Oregon. Thanks so much for spending some time with us in this month's edition of Curious.
Thank you.
All right. Good to have you.